This show is brought to you by Buzzsprout.com, the best and excitingly prettiest way to start a podcast. Chapter 12, Mystery Guest, Part 4. Alquanif, sini ugnas, tna serenti mug propitist, si tipurat des ivici vidnif, et nu sirompe, setenu calu, manitum unu sint nis op ertrunat, Terinis et ingra, tisi dom mureti, si purem teri runcu, tuxi sixa, si rompe it nenti. May bonds in blood intersect with the forgiving, yet vindictive, fluctuating waters of time. May they be one for the duration of necessity and part ways to meet again as the axis of time intended. There's two guys there a-walking through town with two restless guns. Don't you bother to fool them around. They keep the demons on the run, loves. They keep the demons on the run. Bulletproof vests to guard the chest. Incapacitation at a mere request. They can survive with their Vault 55s. They deprive those that evil contrive of their right to thrive. Don't you worry, I can't send them to die. May the battles they be won, boys.
May in battle you be won.
Seven. Don't you think that spell is a little bit extreme? Johnny Merrick muttered, in a vague, rhetorical tone. His left shoulder was growing tender from leaning in wait for me to finish my various incantations and enchantments. Johnny's grandson, Robin Merrick, who always seemed to refer to his elder detective as Uncle Johnny despite their true relation, was doing the same. On the opposite side of the wide, lounging doorframe of Hunter B. McCarthy's front room. Neither of them, despite their prior experiences combined, had quite gotten used to the strange, bendy fashion with which certain facts now functioned. Like the fact that, although it was currently the year 1955 and Robin wasn't born until the late 1980s, he was in fact older than his grandfather slash Uncle Johnny, and also somehow still yet to meet him in the future as someone supposedly older than Robin was now. And Robin would have no technical recollection of events that he was currently living, that would have occurred years before their technical initial meeting. Uncle Johnny, however, would recall these events. Now that Robin thought about it, Johnny would do so rather vividly, but would sound mad whenever he recounted them in his final weeks and days on Earth. Robin had honestly believed that he had been talking gibberish due to his dementia, perhaps getting a few details from various combat encounters during the war and some of his favorite movies mixed up. Now, though, Robin knew exactly what Johnny had been referring to. Robin made the decision not to mention that to the newly mystically initiated detective standing close to his left, watching the shimmering sphere formed around me pulsate in time with my elder expatiations. It expanded and contracted as I controlled my phantom breaths, each inhale keeping me determined and each exhale bringing me strength. I could sense their confusion, their differing reasons for apprehension, but in order for this plan to work, I had to make sure that they were both protected, both their physical beings and their reputations. Can't have two Mareks wandering around L.A., appearing to kill unarmed, seemingly possessed civilians. Not if Johnny still wanted a career. And, thanks to their similar visages, any kill that Robin made would be added to Johnny's body count. There would later have to be a lot of mass memory wiping involved.
Enjoy.
Sparks of light beyond me in the sphere's center began to morph to fire. Two handguns seemingly welded together arose from the flames with a loud metal scraping sound, piercing the two Mareks' ears. The guns were two oversized revolvers, similar to Magnums, yet these were bigger and brighter, almost overblown. Two guns suitable for a demigod's personal security, or at least that was the comparison Robin made in his mind as he watched the rune markings form in bright, hot burns on the gun handles, then move down the barrels in a delicate, chiseled motion. The boiling droplets singed the wood floor. Raising my hands above my head as if in a crowd-hailing motion, I brought my palms together in a single clap, igniting the sparks surrounding the fire and changing their hue to green. This same green fire wasn't quite hot enough to separate the two guns without a little bit of coaxing and pulling on my part. When the two guns were finally separated, Robin could see the grooves cut into each gun barrel's metal more clearly than before, creating the comparable image of a compact vacuum cleaner in his mind. It seemed the two weapons were suitable for dual-wielding, one- or two-handed use. Each gun barrel, it seemed, possessed the ability to extend alongside the handle when necessary. The rune markings began to cool and set, and I uncrossed my legs and once again stood, the guns still hovering beyond my hands. All fire began to extinguish, yet the smoke still remained, lingering in the air and permeating the room with scents of a mystical disposition. Hold out your hands, detectives. Come on, don't be shy now. They are quite cool.
Like hell they are,
both Mareks said in unison as the weapons floated over towards their admittedly steady yet apprehensive soldier grips. Well, I see you two will have no problem remaining synchronous with each other.
Shouldn't be a problem.
The Mareks said, again in unison.
Stop it! You stop!
Darlings, take a breath. Breathe in as the other breathes out. It'll give you more control over your individual actions. Use your synchronization, in some senses, antithetically.
Does this guy ever stop talking like this? Johnny said, impatiently, yet individually.
Unfortunately, no.
Grip the guns, I said, my own version of impatient.
If we don't hurry, we'll miss our window.
What window? Robin asked.
God damn it! Synchronization sealed, I said. You are now the proud joint owners of a set of twin Vault 55s, loaded with non-lethal, self-replicating stun bolts. Their firing systems are based on a cooldown structure, so there's no need to worry about carrying extra mags. All you need to do is reload.
You said the metal was cool,
Robin protested, at least outwardly ignoring my mystical stun gun crash course. I also said the same about your mid-calf combat boots, Tweety Bird. However, on that occasion, I was also lying. And before you think about pointing that gun at me in a threatening fashion, remind yourself from whose fire that weapon arose. Grumbling, Robin holstered the large compact weapon. Then he paused, glancing at Johnny, who seemed to be at a loss as to where to keep his own. Try this. In the blink of an eye, Johnny found himself glancing at a metallic tactical utility belt, not dissimilar from the one his grandson was wearing. It did look slightly out of place along with Johnny's brown 50s two-piece, but practicality was more important.
Not bad, Johnny said, using the magna clamp to fix the weapon to the belt just as Robin had done.
Geez, did I just see a smile? I asked Johnny, teasing.
Is it a crime to smile? Johnny queried.
For your bloodline, it seems it, from time to time.
Redgren wants to know if you're having fun, Robin said, sighing.
It's a possibility,
Johnny said, his face now blank once again.
And these are for you, Tweety Bird, I said,
clicking a pair of AR goggles into being atop Robin's slicked back hair. This tempered with his pride and joy, causing him to immediately remove the goggles from his head and pat down his do.
"Careful," Robin said, hotly.
"You be more careful to bring your own next time, dear."
"What are those things, anyhow?" Johnny asked. "Flight goggles?"
"Among other things," Robin said. "I'll explain later. Let's just say they'll probably be useful."
"Whoa!" Hunter exclaimed, his head poking through the double doors. "New guns? Cool! Can I see? Can I hold one?"
I noticed there were still damp tears drying on Hunter's flaking cheeks, but there was a look of wonder in his eyes that seemed to override all of that. So instead of discouraging the boy entirely, something which the two detectives were both, of course, prone to do when it came to children and weapons, I instead decided to reflect and redirect.
"You like magic, right?"
I asked Hunter, as he slid the double doors closed behind him, the Injustice comic book dangling from his left hand.
"Even better now I know it's real,"
the kid said, then paused, placing the comic down on one of the twin side tables that sat either side of the double doors. Each side table had a single drawer housed within. The handles were also matching, constructed from bronze, sculpted into the shape of a lion's head and mane. Gripping the mane, Hunter pulled open the small drawer, stopped again for a further moment, and then took out the single object housed safely inside. He opened the Injustice Gods Among Us comic book, and then placed the object inside, then closed the book, and turned to reveal the object as a brown, leather-bound bookmark. Then, cocking his head to one side, Hunter finally spoke again.
"My dad never believed it was real, though."
The kid walked over to the other side of the room and placed the comic book atop his father's desk at the dead center. Finally, once again, seeing the two new, shiny Vault 55s, Hunter's cloud of sadness seemed to clear, at least for now. He attempted to poke at the weapon hanging from Robin's belt. Robin did not look amused, but chose instead to humor the kid. Removing the weapon from its holster with a metallic shunk and holding both ends firmly, Robin went down to Hunter's height and let him examine it, never once letting Hunter take the weight in his own hands.
"It's a bit heavy for you, kid. You'll be strong enough one day."
"One day soon, maybe," I said, clearing the excess ritual ash from beneath my calling point.
"Can we not do that now?"
Robin said.
"Please?"
"Fine," I said, moving the living room coffee table out of harm's way with my synapses.
"Hey, Hunter, you ever seen a retroactive portal before?"
Hunter's head shot up from the examination of Robin's weapon. The kid was craning his neck in the same way Robin was, although the expressions on their faces were entirely opposite.
"No. A portal? To, like, another place? No way!"
"Ooh, good. Then you're gonna love this next bit."
"I do not like this next bit," Robin said, as the portal closed behind them.
"Oh, really? You don't?"
Johnny snapped, the sarcasm in his voice almost palpable.
"Because I thought that the dumbfounded look on your face was meant to inspire confidence."
"Welcome to Willowbrook, detectives.
A community apparently so unincorporated that they didn't even think to put any units on Lana and her grandmother after Lacey was found murdered this morning." The two Marricks were staring intently at the carnage that lay before them. An apartment in total ruin. Broken windows, recently cooked food and drink smeared on walls, ceilings, and tile. Books and torn, ruined documents strewn everywhere. Refrigerator overturned. Light bulb, window, and drinking glass tearing through thick, bloodstained velvet curtains and mangled door frames.
"This place looks like a goddamn tornado swept through," Robin exclaimed.
"This is all my fault," Johnny said. "I knew Lana was staying with her grandmother. I should have stopped by sooner." Just then, Johnny remembered his brief but no less strange experience outside Hunter's apartment earlier that morning. The ghostly apparition of his...
"Lana!"
Johnny called, finally finding the courage to step through the mess. Pieces of plates and bits of furniture, wood and glass could be heard splintering and shattering further beneath his weight.
"Lana! Where are you?"
Johnny drew his gun as he made it to the kitchenette area on the apartment's far side. He stared out of the ruined backyard door to his left, focusing on the bits of debris from surrounding windows, trees, and walls littering the stone.
"Two floors up, huh?"
Robin thought to himself, still standing where the portal had initially closed behind him. Robin was also staring to his left, outside the broken window closest to him. There was a jewel store opposite that seemed strangely and contextually familiar to Robin, but he couldn't put his finger on exactly why. What he could see was that, like most other stores in the immediate area, it was wrecked. The establishment's internals no doubt somewhat mirroring the carnage they were currently standing in.
Yeah. Two floors up,
Johnny said, speaking internally to Robin and I for the first time, but not really having time to enjoy the moment.
Looks like somebody broke in from here and trashed the place. We have to...
Johnny stopped. Robin looked away from his own window, now staring at his grandfather, whose words had been halted by whatever was beyond Robin's line of vision. There was something to Johnny's right side. Robin stepped over slowly as Johnny's gun lowered to his right. His left hand began to raise to cover his mouth, but then kept right on raising to grab his hat and remove it. In the way that cops do when...
Hannah!
Johnny exclaimed. He took a few steps then bent down as Robin came around the corner, his eyes falling on the corpse of Lana's grandmother. Her face, arms, legs, and torso were full of shards of glass and stained with yellowing plaster dust. The floral print dress she was wearing looked almost as unrecognizable as Lacey's had in the trunk of Theo's car thanks to the amount of blood and water.
Check her ears, I advised.
Her ears? Robin queried. Why?
Because, although I believe your earlier initial comparison to a bizarre, internally localized weather pattern manifestation, like, say, a tornado sweeping through a second-floor apartment, was not entirely inaccurate, I do not believe that Hannah being helplessly thrown around the room like a ragdoll and receiving a face full of glass was the actual cause of death.
There aren't any puncture wounds, Johnny said, in a focused but no less somber fashion. This was no vampire attack.
I didn't say check her neck. I said check her ears.
Robin knelt down beside Johnny, who was attempting to steady his breathing. The detective out of time touched a tactically gloved hand to the old woman's neck, craning it to the left and resting her head on the ruined bathroom doorframe. The bathroom door itself was hanging off its hinges, but held in place by the proximity of the far inner wall of the tiny bathroom. Robin attempted to block out the state of her face as he pulled back her long, grey hair, revealing what I was expecting, but not exactly hoping or wanting to see.
Jesus Christ, Johnny said, shooting up and turning his back on the corpse.
Is that... Johnny trailed off, his back still turned. Out of sight, Robin nodded.
Yeah.
Old lady brains bleed on a dime, but this is rather extreme.
Not now, Redgrin,
Robin growled, regarding his grandfather's shaking hands by his sides, his gun now holstered.
Just tell me what it means,
Johnny shouted, slamming his fist down on the kitchen counter before him, his eyes screwed firmly closed.
It means, detective, that Hannah's death was not the result of a random rabid possession on the street.
Lana did this. Johnny turned then, his eyes still closed, but his eyebrows raised so high that they were almost lifting from his forehead.
What did you just say?
It wouldn't have been intentional, Robin cut in, beginning to explain.
She's manifesting.
And how do you know this?
How do you think?
I prompted. It's time to truly accept what you already know, something that you have always known, now more than ever.
She's your daughter, isn't she, Johnny?
Yes.
Johnny said this simply, quietly, and internally. No movement of the mouth, no pause for breath of any kind.
Yes, she is.
Johnny locked eyes with his grandson.
And your mother?
Yes, she is. Robin said, internally, mirroring his grandfather. Then Robin spoke up. And she was, is, a very powerful woman. Not least when her powers began to manifest. Well, around now, but it wasn't supposed to happen like this. Robin could see the question,
how was it supposed to happen then?
Written all over his grandfather's drying lips. But for one reason or another, he chose not to ask. Instead, he asked a different, and in my humble opinion, more immediately relevant question.
What exactly is she capable of?
His tone was even. Her focused psychic scream alone can bring the dead back to life on a temporary, rabid kind of basis. And you were right, Robin. Proximity isn't necessarily relevant, but effective range is a factor.
When did I say that?
You will. Anyway, if Lana knows you well enough to internally focus on you, or if you are related to her by blood, your life is in her hands. At this stage, however, even if you aren't linked to her directly or indirectly, the energy manifesting out of her is dark and powerful enough to invade anyone's psyche. I paused for a few seconds. The detectives waited patiently. Truth be told, detectives, she shouldn't be capable of all of this all on her own. Not this early, anyway, which indicates she may be being manipulated in some way by an unknown force. But, and here comes another truth, that isn't even the problem. The real issue we have now is her psychological storms manifest physically in violent ways, as you can see. But it's all fed by her imagination. And you know what they say? The human imagination is never more powerful than in those formative years. Which is why powers manifesting at adolescence, bizarrely, are easier to handle. Which means she doesn't necessarily have any actual control over her traumatic responses. Reasoning with her is going to be far more difficult, Robin said. I would have to guess that she somehow psychically witnessed you pulling her mom's body out of the reservoir this morning. And that's what sent her over the edge. No doubt Hannah attempted to calm her down, and that only enraged her further. Maybe caused her to manifest her first storm. First in here, Robin turned to the ruined backyard exit door and pointed. Then out there. Are you saying that my daughter can make storms? Real storms? Storms usually directly correlating to her mental stability at any given time, and as I said, the imagination. That is the key to how the psyche storm spreads to others, turning them into rabid monsters. Physical manifestations of metaphorical pain. I mean, just look outside. See for yourself. Robin made his way over to the backyard door as Johnny covered up Hannah's body with a blanket. Then he came to join his grandson. Outside, the streets were littered with crashed cars and live, shuddering, struggling, restrained human bodies. Some of them were still enough to look dead, but the occasional twitch told Robin that everyone out there, everyone perhaps who had been in close enough contact with Lana, but may have not been being specifically psychologically targeted by her, were all fighting some kind of internal war with themselves. Maybe, after a certain point, proximity really did have nothing to do with it. Think blood and water, I prompted. Robin thought as the two detectives, guns now drawn once again, made their way down the steps to the rear exit of the apartment building. Then Robin stopped, smiled slightly, and thwacked his head with the barrel of his gun. It hurt more than he was expecting, and he began a delayed reactive wince against the pain. What the hell did you do that for? Johnny asked. The truth, Robin said. What truth? You ever wonder why Mareks tend to go into law enforcement, maybe even try to work their way through governmental positions in their older ages?
Spoiler alert.
What? Never mind him, just answer the question.
We see justice needing done. We can't ignore it, Johnny said, believing in his words, but also somehow worried he was giving his grandson the wrong answers.
Sure, that's one way of putting it. Robin paused his words for a split second, and without looking, pointed his gun to his direct left and pulled the trigger. A rabid possession victim went down yards away, now fixed to the ground, held in a transparent stasis shield, an afterburning effect of the stun bolt device.
Nice shot, kid, Johnny said. I didn't even see you see that guy.
Now, on Johnny's right, another rabid went down, held once again in stasis. Neither Marek had needed to look, but each shot was as accurate as the others.
Neither did I, Robin replied.
They stopped at the bottom of the steps, Robin now poised to finish his point. The way I see it, though, we can tell when others are lying to us. We can see the truth, even if it's hiding. And that's what drives us. Can sometimes drive us into denial, right?
Johnny nodded, almost sheepishly.
Yeah. Yeah, it can.
In terms of power manifestation, Lana's way up there. Higher than most in our bloodline. Psychological focus is the key. Proximity means almost nothing, so let me ask you this. If you were 10 years old, confused and alone, and you had this unchecked, in many cases uncontrollable power to manifest psychological weather patterns and others' emotional states, the ability to actively when trained or passively when untrained morph and change real physical weather patterns, or just scream people to death or the dead back to life, and you knew or recently discovered that your father wasn't exactly who he said he was, not just in his personal life as an adopted father, but his professional life as a crooked cop, a fake upholder of truth and justice. What would you do?
Johnny thought for a moment, cracking off another shot with his Volt 55 without needing to look. I'd teach him a lesson. Even if I didn't really know what that meant. You're goddamn right.
Hunter and I remained behind at his apartment. We were sitting opposite one another, me in a chair clearly made for a being of Hunter's size, and Hunter in his father's king-size leather desk chair, making us both look ridiculously disproportioned. I did have an idea, however, that Hunter B. McCarthy may prove to be the largest piece of this puzzle that was yet to be properly placed. Given that where I was sending the Mareks would almost certainly be filled with RPVs, or rabid possession victims, as I have come to call them in recent seconds, basically any human being affected by Lana's projected manifestations, the grown-ups, and by that I mean Robin and Jonathan, decided it would be best for Hunter to stay in safer surroundings. Not that that would matter later on.
How come we didn't get to go through the portal?
Hunter asked, his tone grumpy. Let's just say we'll be going through a portal of our own soon enough. Right now, you and me have an optical experiment to perform.
What kind of experiment?
The optical kind.
I don't know what that word means.
It is a magical experiment.
Cool.
Hunter's smile had returned in full force. I sighed. We're going to find out what happened to your dad. The smile faded.
How?
By looking through his eyes. I tried very hard as I looked at Hunter in that moment to show absolutely no hint of glee or mischief in my face. But trying to make my face do that is hard, even if it was how I felt. And so I turned away, making my way into the center of the living space where I had previously opened the portal to Willowbrook. Do you mind if I temporarily remove that? I don't think we'd want it getting damaged. I pointed a finger at the painting of Hunter's mother, Melissa. We need some wall space for this experiment.
Sure. I guess. Just be careful.
I'm always careful.
Sure you are.
Ignoring Hunter's jab, I removed the painting from the wall and set it down gently to the side. Behind the painting was a simple, bare, nicotine-stained wall with some ancient-looking screw-eye holes and a whole lot of dust and cobwebs. I exhaled firmly. The dust and spidery debris evaporated. I need your father's afro comb.
Why?
Let's just say it's the most respectful and least harrowing technique for obtaining his DNA post-mortem.
What's DNA?
Just get it.
Why do you need my dad's hair?
Enough with the questions, I said, lighting a cigarette I pinched from Robin when he wasn't looking.
Blech,
I exclaimed, exhaling.
These things are truly disgusting. Well, then why did you light it then?
I'm not smoking the bloody thing. Cigarette smoke is the best catalyst for the viewing of memories. Any smoke works, but I think setting fire to anything in this apartment that belongs to either you or your father would just add insult to injury.
Mukti lensfa no rarome.
At that moment, the smoke escaping the end of the lit cigarette began to intensify, the cigarette itself becoming smoke. No ash evident anywhere.
Whoa!
Hunter exclaimed. The plume of smoke was now pure and dense, positioned in the palm of my hand like a fully transparent smoke grenade with no pin.
Wait for it,
I grinned, moving towards the bare wall and positioning my hand correctly. I took a deep breath and exhaled. The smoke flew from the center of my hand, hitting the wall and dispersing in the space where the painting had been situated for years. Hunter's eyes remained fixed on the smoke. I could tell he was expecting it to dissipate, but it didn't. The plume of smoke remained, circling the square space of plaster.
Now what?
I put out my hand.
Comb.
Hunter handed it to me, watching me remove strands of his late father's extensive graying afro hair from the bottom of the comb's teeth where it always collected. I rolled the hair up into a ball between my two hands, then held them out in a motionless motion of prayer and began to chant.
Avia memoria, avia maxis tenetur, altuis realm, reveal malum, quod hic et ulciscar animam tuam.
My hands were now on fire, much to Hunter's alarm, but just as before with the smoke, I reassured him.
Wait for it. Deep breath. 2, 3. No smoke without fire.
The shapes and images that followed through the smoke weren't exactly 4K resolution worthy, but they got the point across.
a point that I'm not exactly sure Hunter really needed hammered home any more than it already had been. Caesar's soul had been taken by the creature that Theodore Law had become. His appearance was not unlike that of the original vampires. No sparkles or confusingly exciting leather garments, just pale, naked death. Almost dark, pale death. Eyes as yellow as a burning, lying sun. A mouth that also opened at the midpoint of his chin, creating a spanning, gaping chasm-like mouth of fear that made Hunter hide his eyes.
Fear stands for fuck everything and run, I whispered to Hunter internally.
I was expecting him to jump at a voice in his head, but he didn't. Instead, still hiding his face, he muttered,
You're goddamn right.
He looked up then, his fear of the vampire not enough to override his curiosity, his hatred for the creature. We weren't able to see much of the actual killing, which I was grateful for. We mostly witnessed the side of Theodore Law's newly metaphysically scalped head occasionally twitch as Caesar's blood was drained, most likely along with his soul. The images in the smoke began to flicker as Caesar's eyes became heavier. Just before they closed for the final time, the image of a small figure floating transparently in the background formed almost as quickly as it disappeared. I chanted the final image into a tableau, staring intently, just to be sure. I could tell that it was Lana, or it looked to be her, as she was no doubt overseeing this particular part of her revenge personally, whether she knew what she was doing or not. There must be a puppet master involved. Relishing something like this at the age of 10 years old wasn't abnormal, but it was uncommon, even for ones as powerful as Lana. It was what Hunter said next, however, that I did not expect.
I think I know that girl.
What's that now?
I think I got something, Robin said, kneeling down at the roadside, about 20 yards away from the bottom of the rear steps of Lana's grandmother's residence. He had the AR goggles fixed around his eyes. Cover me while I scan this glass, would you?
No problem, Johnny said.
Take this, Robin said, throwing him his vault. Makes things easier. Johnny was now standing guard in the way good soldiers do when out in the open, constantly moving in a circular pattern around his grandson, both guns raised, pointed in opposite directions, bringing them parallel for split seconds here and there once he had finished checking all of his blind spots. The two of them had managed to incapacitate many of the RPVs still tearing up and down this particular street, but the Marics had come to the conclusion that Lana couldn't be too far if the storm of hers still seemed to be focused on its origin point of southwest LA.
Tweety Bird, I whispered.
What? Robin said, out loud. I'm busy.
I'm busy too,
but I've still had time to subconsciously patch into the LAPD's communications network.
How the hell did you pull that off?
Johnny asked, still checking his blind spots.
I put a bug in someone's ear. Never mind that. Just listen.
They listened. What they heard was a short and rather heated discussion between Luke Phelps, Johnny's temporary replacement partner, and Michael Connolly, the Los Angeles County coroner.
How the hell can a body with just one arm and leg escape from the goddamn morgue?
Johnny shouted. Resurrection or no resurrection, that don't make a lot of sense. I have absolutely no idea, Robin said, but I do think I've picked up Lana's trail. This blood, the DNA on this piece of window glass, it matches ours. And from what I can see, it leads southwest of here.
Could take a while.
Give me a second, detectives.
Okay, I'm reading your destination as Roosevelt Memorial Park. It's a near 2-hour walk if the streets were clear. Even if you run, it'll still take too long.
Sounds like you boys need a ride.
Most of the roads are gonna be blocked up though, right?
Johnny said, firing another self-replicating, non-lethal round into the shoulder of an oncoming RPV.
You let me worry about that, detective.
The Vincent Black Shadow motorcycle I had chosen for their journey was a quick and nimble classic constructed in the late 40s. 1955, it would later turn out, would be the last year of its production. It's much easier manifesting transportation that was actually in existence and, better yet, production in the year in question. Plus, given that it had been dubbed the fastest production motorcycle in the world in 1948, I figured it would be good enough to get the two detectives to their destination in record time. Especially with Robin behind the... bars.
The journey itself was mostly made in zigzag motions from sidewalk to sidewalk, to avoid crashed vehicles and static, incapacitated RPVs. Sidewalks, though, meant narrowly avoiding charging and or fleeing civilians. This mainly occurred when they initially headed west on El Segundo Boulevard. But luckily, by the time they had banked south on Interstate 110, the roads were far clearer, still littered with jammed up vehicles in certain lanes, but nothing the Shadow couldn't handle. Robin was driving, and I could tell he was subconsciously enjoying the hell out of it. Jonathan was on mobile guard duty, and had been quickly and smoothly incapacitating RPVs as the Shadow moved at near top speed. Johnny was, of course, dual-wielding the guns in their retracted form, and had the freedom of the use of both of his hands, thanks to the twin magna clamps that could connect the two detective utility belts together. This could be done either at short or long range with the use of osmium-dipped wire cabling. At first, Johnny hadn't exactly trusted the clamps, but once the belt's G-force dampeners kicked in, when the bike reached 80 miles an hour, the sense of magnetic security seemed to increase, and the faster they got, the more comfortable Johnny seemed to feel. Two men, with matching faces, riding through the streets of Los Angeles, shooting at crazed infected civilians on the fastest production motorbike in the world. One wearing a tactical flight suit from the mid to late 23rd century, the other a fedora and pale Columbo-style trench coat, billowing gracefully in the quickening storm. Robin did eventually have to slow down when the roads became too slippery to accurately avoid obstacles at high speeds, human or otherwise. My point is this, listeners. The journey lasted just under 15 minutes, and during that interlude, thanks to the ease and security of the ride itself, the two detectives had time to talk. And this is how that conversation went. Apologies for the inevitable background gunfire and the even more inevitable screaming of engines, both mechanical and mortal. I was a cop in Chicago PD, Robin began. Homicide. Like you, I guess. Can tell a cop a mile away, especially if he looks exactly like me, Johnny said, a laugh in his voice. Johnny noticed between shots that Robin had a cigarette in his mouth and was talking as the cigarette dangled. Johnny wasn't sure where or how he had found the time to do that. Should you really be smoking while riding this fast? Johnny asked, sounding to Robin's ear exactly like, well, his grandfather in his older age. This made Robin smile, as much as he was capable of with a high-five parliament hanging from his mouth. His confidence may have also been boosted by the obstacle tracking range the AR goggles provided. You don't need to worry about me, Robin said, his mouth sounding slightly full. He leaned further forward on the Shadow. Don't I? Johnny fixed the back of his grandson's head with a sharp stare. Not to be rude, but from what I've seen, you look like hammered shit, son. That is quite rude, Robin said, but couldn't help a small, one-sided smile. Truth hurts, boy. I mean, don't get me wrong. You're great in a crime scene. Great out in the field, quick-thinking, nimble, focused. But that sure as hell don't change that look in your eyes. You gonna give me the rundown? Robin considered his words, attempting to be as honest and as vague as possible. In the future, there's this thing. Robin trailed off. In the future, there's this thing? Johnny laughed. Well, it's nice to know you picked up a strong vocabulary, Robin sighed, and during said exhale, I tickled his ear. Vague truth, detective. There's nothing wrong with telling him the rules, bendy as they are. He's part of you. He will understand. Robin took another breath, inwardly returning his grandfunkel's sharp stare. Did I just hear you say grandfunkel? Did I just hear you perform a narrative response? Detective? It's never happened before. Anyway, were you just talking to Redgren there? Johnny asked. I couldn't hear him. Kind of, yeah. Also just trying to find the words to...
To what?
Johnny pushed.
Well, to explain. It's pretty complex.
More complex than my grandson riding a Vincent Black Shadow in 1955 while I ride shotgun shooting down demons? Not only that, my grandson's ahead of me in the wrinkle department. And my daughter, your mother, is causing, what did Redgren call them? Psych storms? And actual storms? Yes, just listen. It's not just about me being from the future. If certain things are revealed in the past to the wrong people at the wrong times, then things could change. Things that could affect people we don't even know.
You're saying that I'm the wrong person? Given how integral you are to, well, quite a few things, you having certain foreknowledge could be dangerous. You think I'm gonna break under questioning if some demon king gets a hold of me? Honestly, I hadn't even considered that. We Mareks don't tend to get captured often. We don't tend to let it happen.
That is something we can agree on. Come on, son, lay it on me.
Robin glanced around them, at the newly mangled streets and damaged buildings, the spattered brick and splattered faces. Then he made a decision.
You think this is bad, right here? And right now? Well, the sad thing is, this is just a drop in the ocean compared to what's coming. Not necessarily in your lifetime, I'm sorry to say, or maybe I'm not, but it's been lying in wait for years. This here? This can be fixed, swept away, erased, restored. With a little bit of legwork. And what's coming can't be? Truth be told, I'm not sure, Pop. I can hope that one day I can find a way to avert the Dark Pale crisis. Finally gain access to a working time drop point. But Robin trailed off again, as the images of his past mistakes, his to him inherent failures, flooded his consciousness. What exactly is, or was, the Dark Pale crisis? I don't have time to explain everything, but in a nutshell, a fluctuating point in time that became fixed. Constant. Something that is always meant to happen. Written on the hands of fate. It just is. But usually when fixing anachronisms in time, you can revert one to the other or vice versa, so that history remains malleable.
Someone's been paying attention in time travel class, Johnny said, smirking.
You joke, but Redgrin does run a series of live lectures that are pretty much mandatory for all living recruits. And when the rules of time change, which does happen, either after a great deal of effort or a huge amount of mistakes, you'd be stupid not to attend. The audio is mostly always recorded in some way if attendance is impossible, which also does happen.
Johnny seemed lost for words, and so Robin continued. The problem is that at a certain point, a certain asshole, not native to the planet Earth, found a way to prevent reversion. Seemingly permanently, basically prevents any access to any stable time drop points. Points in time that are integral to the initial aversion or reversion of the anachronism itself. Moments that, if changed, would have a rippling effect on all the ones that follow. And in some cases, what came before. Without that access, the anachronism reversion isn't possible. Not even Redgrin can break through this one. And what exactly was it you were called to the front line to fight? And what exactly happened that was so terrible that not being able to change it back keeps you and even your magical smiling friend up at night?
Robin took a deep breath. An engineered pathogen. A pretty disgusting mix of science and magic, chemical and mystical warfare working hand in hand, infecting everyone it touches, infecting everyone differently. I was sent in with a bunch of enhanced soldiers to evacuate survivors, help find the cause and the cure. There was a capture or kill order out on a man named Arkham Void, Captain Arkham Void, the supposed key, or one of them, to the existence and the eradication of the virus. The brief painted him as guilty. Evil. But it turned out that he had been used by various military factions both on and off-world for most of his life. Brainwashed and displaced in time, in the grips of morally bankrupt handlers, making him perform horrible tasks in the name of the highest bidder, over and over again. Until one day, he escaped in the company of a few others. They got separated via teleport, a very powerful matter manipulation device that disassembles you in one place, then reconstitutes you in another. None of them realized, though, that the emergency teleport they all simultaneously used was temporal, meaning they weren't just displaced in space, but also time. Johnny was nodding and tutting, as Robin continued to explain, but didn't find himself faltering in either belief or understanding. Where would not believing his grandson actually get him? Given what was going on, absolutely nowhere. Robin continued, also lighting another cigarette, temporarily riding one-handed, much to his grandfather's internal disapproval. Thanks to a little help from Redgrin and some others, they all managed to find each other in time to come together and fight on the front line of the Dark Pale crisis. A crisis they all felt responsible for, because parts of all their DNA helped create the virus in the first place. And this virus could make monsters like we can fire a gun. I felt honored to fight alongside such good soldiers. And they became my friends.
Jesus. So, what did you do? When you got to the front line, Robin sighed. His eyes began to water. We did what soldiers do. We planned. We agonized over details. We had good ideas that could have worked if we hadn't been so goddamn outnumbered. We had close combat, long range, mystics, giant, strong, friendly-ass monsters fighting on our side, a mechanical army garrison, and it still wasn't enough. It wasn't enough, Pop. A single tear ran down Robin's right cheek. Holstering one of the Vault 55s, Johnny put a hand on his grandson's shoulder. We lost. Everyone lost. America was, will be, destroyed. And it's irreversible.
Virtually irreversible,
I corrected. It's irreversible, Robin shouted. Johnny heard me and tightened his grip on his shoulder. You and your friend have shown me things that I never even thought were slightly possible. Who knows? You might yet find a way to set things right. I mean, that's why you're here, isn't it? To help me set things right? Robin thought about it. His grandfather's words seemed to break through to a part of his mind that didn't see much stimulation. The education of revelation as opposed to complete axiomatic disintegration. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. And hey, even if all of this wasn't meant to happen originally, and it's as a result of what happens to you in the future, don't feel bad. At least we got to meet. Spend some time. Kick ass. Johnny tightened his grip further still. And Robin began to grin. Yeah. Yeah, I guess you're right. Roosevelt Memorial Park was finally in sight. They stopped, staring at the rain-soaked gate, its mouth hanging open, RPV standing guard in the shadows of the swirling clouds. This is it, Robin said. This is where Theo was buried, Johnny said. Makes sense you'd be in there, then. Christ knows what else is, though. The two Merricks both took a simultaneous, deep, slow breath, their synchronization stronger than ever. Now, let's go fix this, Johnny said.
Together.
Oh, dear me, I said, as Hunter and I, along with Caesar's body in a simple stasis field, exited the portal from Hunter's apartment to Roosevelt Memorial Park. Hunter hopped through after me with a grave mixture of tentativeness and excitement. This place is supposed to be pretty, but the sun still appears to be hiding. It won't appear again until this is over. What do we do? Hunter asked. You stay close. I can extend my protections, but the range is pretty limited, so if you do have to run, run fast and do not look back. I wouldn't even know where to go, Hunter said, his tone resistant. I'll be able to guide you. Up here. I put two fingers to my right temple. But to make that easier, let's see where we are. I put a finger to my ear. House, activate the outer layer AR projection of our current location. Nice and bright. There's a good girl.
Augmented reality projection commencing.
Who was that? Hunter asked.
Someone very important. Now, never mind that. Pay attention.
Hunter's eyes looked wider with wonder than I had ever seen them. The portal to Hunter was less impressive than this fake-ass map. An augmented reality map of the entire memorial complex, I began as Hunter followed my eyeline. Looks like we have emerged here. I walked into the map itself, passing through the scaled-down location like a ghost. Hunter did the same, following my lead to the almost exact yet scaled-down center of the complex.
The Courts of Grace. How appropriate.
So that girl, Lana? She's close by somewhere?
Indeed, my pocket-sized monster hunter.
I'm not a monster hunter.
Give it time. And yes, Lana is here, and she is very close.
Behind us, blaster bolt shots of, to my ear, a very specific setting, began to sound in the direction of the southeast entrance.
It seems the detectives have made it too. Let's get moving.
Which way do we go?
That way, I said, switching the large map to the minimized version on my chrono. Northwest. Let's go. Remember, stay close.
Darkness loomed above us all like a puppet master of eternal sin. Mareks feed on lies, chew them up, and spit out the truth. That is their nature, their calling. Truth. But truth, as you know, my dreadful darlings, comes in many forms. For instance, the true face and form of the deceitful adopted father, Theodore Law. The deals with the crime families, the part he and others proved to be linked to him, played in the cover-up of Melissa McCarthy's murder in 1946, the leaks during the investigation into Elizabeth Short, the harsh and clearly racially motivated fashion with which Theodore would pressure Caesar McCarthy for information on the heroin trade. Caesar knew Theo was dirty, and knew Theo was guilty, and above all else, had to endure the humiliation and pain of time period-specific racial compartmentalization. Theodore Law hated black people, hated anyone who wasn't the same color as him. The kind of soldier that found joy in murdering those he saw as less than him during the war, under the guise of serving his country. It wasn't because of what they fought for. Theo didn't much care what they were fighting for. Either side, freedom, survival, tyranny, whatever. He was just a man who hated, and would find any reason to do so. He began to hate and resent who he thought was his daughter after he'd worked out that she wasn't his, not to mention his wife. Of course, Theo wasn't exactly ecstatic to find out that Lacey was also now sleeping with, no, had possibly fallen for, a lowly black jazz musician. The very same one that Theo would drunkenly berate racially while Caesar played out his heart and soul on the few occasions Theodore and Lacey had attended together for hosted functions. Caesar's soul, his true heart and soul, would be bared out when he played. The pain of the loss of his wife, of raising his son alone, all while handling a semi-lucrative secret life where one wrong move could get him or possibly even his son killed, feeling trapped and yet freed by the simultaneous love and hatred of his fellow man. Lacey must have seen Caesar's soul in its purity and its utter complexity, its righteousness, while also seeing her husband's true soul, his true self. And from that first night those two souls were bared, Lacey's hate for her husband and her love for Caesar expanded tenfold. Theodore Law drained out a righteous man's soul, and in my book, that was unforgivable. I mention all of this, listeners, because both Theodore and Lacey's final demonic forms, or rather, form, created by all this aforementioned love and aforementioned lies and deceit, was somewhat difficult to describe. Lana's anger for her mother's part in events hadn't done Lacey any favors, despite her pure love for Caesar's righteous soul, and Lana's anger for her father had morphed him into one of the most grotesque-looking creatures I had ever laid my eyes upon. Not least because what was left of Lacey was now somehow stitched onto Theodore's demonic body, like a novelty tumor. It was possible, though I couldn't be sure, that Lacey's living corpse was retrieved by an RPV and seemingly dragged over 6 miles to this memorial complex. Lana's anger at Theo for attempting to hide his crime, no doubt warranting more severe punishment. It wasn't as if the Theo thing, as I decided to call it, looked or seemed confident in its new appearance. All I could see, hear, and feel from it was blinding pain. Pain also sourced from Lacey, who was, of course, still alive. Hunter looked terrified, but I had briefed him on his task in this final confrontation on the short journey over to the Courts of Grace, at the center of which the intermittent demonic screaming was sourced. Hunter had protested, pointing out flaws in my plan that I had also noticed, but after I had said the words, "You have both lost people. People who can never come back the way they were before. Help her to see that she is not alone." Hunter's following nod showed that I was understood. I was arming this child with a weapon, one that can be more powerful and effective than any gun. The power of words. More specifically, the emotional bonds formed through words consisting of nothing but truth. Lana wasn't exactly easy to talk down, and needed a little bit of mystical assistance from yours truly, but I merely turned down the noise long enough for Hunter's words to be heard. It worked. Only just. We were completely surrounded, and if the detectives hadn't turned up when they did, with Johnny shooting from a sniping position using the extended barrel, while Robin covered close-range combat, keeping the RPVs off Hunter and going toe-to-toe with the Theo thing. I wouldn't have been able to hold Lana in stasis, Hunter wouldn't have been able to get through to her, and in the end, a temporal ripple effect, like the sudden unexplained and seemingly self-inflicted destruction of half of Los Angeles in 1955, could have remained irrevocably changed. House has almost never taken me where I wanted to go, listeners. In truth, I came to 1955 to get away from my own grandmother. Maybe hit a couple of jazz bars, take in a show, and of course, to police this bond that seemed to be forming between Gigi and her cancer-ridden rescue bird. He honestly had no idea what the hell he was getting into. Seriously. But regardless, House has always led me, guided me, to where I needed to be. And for that, I am literally eternally grateful. There's just something about this bloodline that the twisted hands of fate view as truly important. The Marek's empirical search for truth, perhaps. The vague yet no less powerful source of their abilities. The power level varying from descendant to descendant. The abilities themselves varying. The strangely, historically strategic points at which they have existed throughout time. Their direct links to multiple crisis points. Their resilience and somewhat defiance of, well, of me. This is why I must keep them close, closer than maybe comfortable on my part. The cleanup from this averted anachronism was going to be extensive, and I couldn't do it alone. All these words I say, listeners, I believe them. I believe in them. But I've had to use a lot of them in this final rambling section to try and understand how the hell what happened. Because all Lana had to say was one. One word that ensured she would not be leaving my side until the mystery of this word was resolved. The only word that she spoke directly to me before Hunter stepped in. And she looked me right in the eyes as she had done so, making me freeze in a way I never had before. One word, listeners. Zerzero. End of part 4.
If you're a podcast clown like I am, you must have dreamed about starting your own. Let me tell you, my dreadful darlings, it's never easy, but it's one of the best decisions I ever made. It was either that or waste away in my own subjective ascendance. Of course, it can be more than just a little overwhelming to know how to get started. Buzzsprout can help you launch your podcast professionally and in style, linking you with all of the major podcasting platforms such as Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and much, much more. Join us up in the buzzing, sprouting podcast cloud to breathe in the renowned analytical sound of the accurate analysis and promotion tools provided. Follow the link in the show notes below to start your journey and receive a $20 Amazon gift card. We're waiting for you. Buzzsprout, the best and excitingly prettiest way to start a podcast.